Coming to New Jersey every year is the highlight of my year. This year, we were able to schedule it after the semester is over, so it's even nicer because I don't have to go back on Monday to teach more classes. So it's really a pleasure to be here with everyone. My gratitude to all the devotees here, to the temple, and particularly to Nilamani Poo and his family for hosting us and for organizing the visit. When every year Nilamani Poo asks me what the topic for next year is going to be, and as we think back and forth what to do, this particular time, the topic is called In Defense of Lord Rama. And it comes from a lifelong, really, experience with Ramayana, one that I think pretty much everyone in this room probably shares to some extent. The Ramayana is one of those stories which they say that no Indian ever hears for the first time, as in no one can remember, oh, the first time I heard the story of Ramayana. Right? If I asked you the first time you heard the story of Harry Potter, you could probably remember, right? And maybe you've never even heard of it, which is good for you. It's with the Ramayana, it's a story that is part of our life. It's part of our blood. It's just there in the system. It's in the society. It's in the culture. And yet, it's a story which is, these days, I've found in India and outside of India also, deeply unpopular and becoming more and more so. And it often has to do with the fact that it has to do with Lord Ram's character and how people perceive him as being someone who is selfish and focused on his own, improving his own position and his own status in society, his rule as a king, and in the process is willing to mistreat those who come in his way. Specifically, of course, Mother Sita, who is banished by Lord Ramachandra at the end, who goes through a trial by fire, Agni Pariksha, after she suffers at the hands of Ravana, and other such types of criticisms of Lord Ramachandra, of the story of the Ramayana as a whole, as being a story that is not useful for our times today, that is not useful for modern India, for the world, that's an outdated story with problems and issues. And it's those things that you hear again and again that prompted me to say, why don't I read the Ramayana and find out what the Ramayana actually says? Because so often people in India and Indians in general talk about the Ramayana as if they know the story and as if they know Lord Rama and they know the Ramayana and the Gatha and everything, when in fact very few people today actually read the Ramayana. The vast majority of people just hear about it here and there. At best, they've watched the TV series. And that's the Ramayana, and that's the Bible, and that's everything. And from that, then they make all kinds of decisions about what Lord Ram is and what the Ramayana is. So that's the idea behind the seminar. Is the first part, I want to talk about the Ramayana itself, its significance, its importance, its relevance for us as devotees. And the second part, that is tomorrow, we'll talk specifically about the controversies connected with Lord Ram's story. Okay? So today's the significance of the Ramayana for us, and the second part is the problems or perceived problems associated with the Ramayana. And then the Sunday feast class is going to be a continuation on one particular theme of the Ramayana that has to do with Hanumanji. Yes. So that's kind of the plan for the weekend. So with hopefully plenty of time for any questions that you might have. So let's begin with prayers. Om Jnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Viditam Jena Tasmay Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Jena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurum Vaishnavanscha Shri Rupam Sagra Jatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tamasajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhanvitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dinabandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyaye Vacha Patitanam Patanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
So what makes the seminar particularly nice is speaking in front of Lord Ramachandra himself. This is not an opportunity you get very often. So also I have to be very careful in what I say because, you know, Lord Ramachandra's one arrow can finish you off pretty quickly. So anything wrong comes out of my mouth, but it's dangerous, right?
The arrow in his hand, right?
Yes, I know. In Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's pastimes, there's one devotee. His name is Murari Gupta. There's no relationship with me at all. But Murari Gupta, he was a great devotee of Mahaprabhu, a close associate. He really was devoted to Lord Ramachandra. And one day, Mahaprabhu, in a rather playful manner, he talked to him about how ultimately Krishna is the Supreme Lord, and he's the cause of all causes, the origin of all other avatars, and therefore you ought to worship Krishna. And receiving this instruction from Mahaprabhu, Murari Gupta thought, I should do it. I should try. Mahaprabhu has asked me to. And so he tried and he tried and he tried, and he could not get himself to meditate for very long on Krishna at all. His mind would immediately go to Lord Ramachandra. And he became so distraught, he couldn't sleep all night, struggling and crying and thinking, here on the one hand is the instruction of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is Lord Ramachandra himself, who is Krishna himself. He's asked me to do this. And on the other hand is my devotion to Lord Ramachandra, which I cannot get rid of. And so, or even supersede. And what should I do? And so he decided that because both options were essential and he couldn't do either one, he might as well give up his life. And so with that determination, he went to see Mahaprabhu one last time, or he came to see him in the morning. And Mahaprabhu was very, very kind and very loving. And he started smiling and laughing and saying, actually, how is it possible that you could even think of giving up the remembrance of Lord Ramachandra? Because actually, you are none other than Hanuman who has returned. And so it's impossible for Hanumanji to meditate on any form but that of Lord Ramachandra. And he became very pleased with him and blessed him to eternally be a servant of Lord Ram. On another occasion described in Chaitanya Bhagavat, Murari Gupta was present there with other devotees, and Mahaprabhu saw him, singled him out, and said, Murari Gupta, I heard that you composed these
prayers, these beautiful verses for Lord Ramachandra. 8 verses, Ramashtaka. I want to hear them, please. Recite them for us. And Murari Gupta did. And after he finished these verses, the Lord was so pleased that he wrote the name of Lord Ram on Murari Gupta's forehead and blessed him that eternally may your devotion to Lord Ramachandra be ever intact. So you can see kind of how even in Mahaprabhu's pastimes, where he's so dedicated to Lord Krishna, there's a very special place for Lord Ramachandra. And what I thought we could do for the seminar is, just to get us into the right mood, is begin by reciting these prayers by Murari Gupta, the Ramashtaka, which are have a very nice melody to them and relatively easy to recite. So these will come around to you in a minute. The melody for these verses is just like the Govindam prayers. So, Chintamani Prakara Sadmatukalpa Vriksha, like that, okay? Similar melody. There's a couple typos in this, so there's a couple places where it might not work out exactly, but most of it should be okay. So, what I thought we could do is recite all 8 verses together, and then recite all the translations together, okay? That creates a nice flow. Okay, so we'll do them all together in one voice, starting with verse number 1.
Agre dhanur dhara varakana kochvalango jyeshthanu sevanarato varabhushanantya Sheshakhyata Mahamavara Lakshmana Namayasya Ramam Jagatraya Gurum Satatam Bhajami Hatva Karatrishirasau Sakarnauka Bandham Shri Dandakana Namadushana Meva Kripva Sugriva Maitra Makarod Vinihatya Shakram Ramam Jagatraya Gurum Satatam Bhajami Rajat Kirita Manidihitititasham Udyat Bhaspati Kavim Pratime Bahanta Dve Kundalenka Rahitindu Samana Vatra Ramam Jagatraya Gurum Satatam Bhajami Udyat Vibhakara Marichi Vibhoditabja Netra Subimba Dashana Chada Charunasam Shubhra Shurashmi Parinirjita Charuhasa Ramam Jagatraya Gurum Satatam Bhajami Takambu Kantama Jamambu Jatulya Rupa Muktavalitanakaharathavrathabhantam Vidyudvalaka ganasayutamambhudapha Aramajagatraya gurum satatam bhajami Uttanahastatadasashtasahasrapatra Panchachadadhikashataprabharambulibhi Kurvatya Sita Kanaka Yudhiyasya Sita Parshve Sitam Prabhuvaram Satatam Bhajami Yoraghavendra Kula Sindhu Sudhashurupa Maricha Rakshasa Sarsvabhu Mukhani Hatya Yajnyam Raraksha Kushikanvaya Punya Rashi Ramam Jagatraya Gurum Satatam Bhajami Bhankva Pinakam Akaro Janakatma Jaya Vaivahikotsava Vidhipati Bhagavendram Jitva Pitur Mudamubahu Kakutsavarya Ramam Jagatraya Gurum Satatam Bhajami इत्थं निशम्य रघुनन्दन राजसिंहा श्लोकाष्टकं स भगवान् चरणामुरारे वैद्यस्य मूर्नि विनिधाय विलेख बाले त्वं रामदास इति भो भव मत्प्रसादा.
Let's read the translation all together also. I constantly worship Lord Ramachandra, the Guru of the three worlds. Before him stands Sri Lakshmana, who is the best of the archers, whose bodily complexion is like molten gold, who is engaged in the service of his elder brother, who is wonderfully decorated, and who is the form of Ananta Shesha. I constantly worship Lord Ramachandra, the Guru of the three worlds, who destroyed Kara, Trishira, Kabandha, and their followers, who rid the Dandakaranya forest of the demon Bhushana, and who killed Vali and made friends with Sugriva. Although his face is like a spotless moon, it is further brightened by a shining crown of jewels. His earrings resemble Jupiter and Venus rising in the evening sky. I forever worship his Lord, Sri Rama, Guru of the three worlds. When he awakens and opens his lotus eyes, their luster resembles the early rays of the rising sun. His teeth are encircled by his charming lips, which are red like the bimba fruit. His nose is shapely and graceful, and upon seeing the beams of his beautiful smile, the moon with its white rays accepts defeat. I forever worship this Lord, Sri Rama, Guru of the three worlds. The throat of the unborn Lord is like a three-ringed conch shell, and his form is as soft as the lotus. He wears a shining necklace of pearls set in gold, and thus he resembles a water-laden cloud accompanied by flashes of lightning and a flock of cranes. Such is Sri Rama, Guru of the three worlds, whom I perpetually adore. In her upraised hand, Sita Devi holds a thousand-petaled lotus flower, and her five graceful fingers make it appear that the flower's hundreds of petals are covered by another five petals. I forever worship Rama, best of the Raghu dynasty, by whose side forever remains the Sita, whose radiance is like molten gold. He who was like the moon shining nectar on the ocean of the Raghu dynasty slew the foremost among the man-eating demons, Marich and Subahu, and thus protected the sacrifice performed by the sage Vishvamitra for the welfare of his ancestors. I worship this Lord, Sri Rama, Guru of the three worlds. After breaking Shiva's bow, he married Sita, daughter of Maharaj Janaka. Then on the path home, he defeated the mighty Parashuram, best of Rigu's line, bringing pleasure to Maharaj Dasharatha, his father. I worship forever this Lord, Sri Rama, the foremost descendants of Kakutsa and Guru of the three worlds. After hearing these eight verses composed by the physician Murari describing Sri Rama, lion among kings and delight of the Raghu dynasty, the Supreme Lord Gaura Hari placed his feet on the physician's head, wrote the words Ram Das on his forehead, and proclaimed, O Murari, by my mercy be forever Sri Rama's servant. So beautiful, beautiful verses. The story of the Ramayana is not just a story that belongs to India. This is one of the most powerful stories in the history of the world, one of the most influential stories in the history of the world. Just as the story of the Bible and of Jesus has played such a shaping role in the history of Western society and culture, you can watch movies and you can read novels and you can hear songs and popular culture, so many different aspects, you will hear references to the Bible. In the same way with the Ramayana story, the Ramayana has been influential in shaping all of Asia and Asian civilization, and more recently, even outside of Asia. So if you travel to many different parts of the world, so for example, if you go to Thailand and you visit Bangkok and you see the old the palaces that are present there, the kings are called Rama I, Rama II, Rama III. These were the titles that they took as they saw themselves trying to rule as Lord Ramachandra did. The ancient capital of Thailand for some time was called Ayutthaya, which is essentially the same thing as Ayodhya. If you go to Cambodia and you go to Angkor Wat and many other wats or temples, you will find huge, beautiful relief carvings of the story of the Ramayana throughout the country. And as you move further north through China, Japan, and Korea, each one of these civilizations has their own tradition of Ramayana storytelling and performance. Even in Indonesia, which today is the world's largest Muslim country, in its ancient times was very much influenced by Vedic culture and particularly by the story of the Ramayana. And they have a long-standing tradition still alive today of Ramayana shadow puppets, where there's a screen and the puppeteers are behind the screens with a light behind them that shines shadows onto the screen, and people see and hear the story of the Ramayana like this. Similarly, if you go to Bali, they have a beautiful form of dance / theater that they perform in their own indigenous styles of decoration and dance, and it's telling the story of the Ramayana. Not too long ago, Japan created an animated version of the Ramayana, which many of you may have seen or heard about. That version was not made for an Indian market, right? It was made by the Japanese for themselves. It was part of their tradition and their culture, and they too love to tell the story of the Ramayana. Similarly in Korea, similarly in China, you can find over 300 different versions of the Ramayana in different parts of the world. In every language, practically speaking, of the world, every language of India for sure, from South Indian languages to Urdu in the north, all the different North Indian languages, hundreds of different versions, the Ramcharitmanas by Tulsidas. There's South Indian versions like the Kamban Ramayana and so on, which are classics in their own cultures, in their own languages that people read and appreciate. So hundreds and hundreds of different Ramayanas all over the world. And even in stories here in the United States, their story of the Ramayana has arrived. So there was that movie for children, The Little Princess. I don't know if any of you have seen that or if your kids have seen it, but it was basically a really nice story of this little girl who the heart of that movie is her telling, reenacting the story of the Ramayana to her friends, and she's going through some circumstances herself and so on. So that the story has universal appeal. And one basic reason why it has universal appeal is because it has all the ingredients of a good story. Right? You've got the prince, and you've got the princess, and you've got the damsel in distress, and that's part of every wonderful story in different parts of the world. The princess who is rescued by the prince when she's captured by the evil demon or the ogre, rescued, and they live happily ever after, and so on. So it's got all the ingredients of a nice story: prince, princess, demons, villains, all of that, love, adventure, romance, it's all there in the story of the Ramayana. But at the same time, it has a lot more than just a good story to offer. The Ramayana itself and traditionally in India is called Adikavya. And Adikavya means the first poem, the first piece of poetry. So, when we normally talk, like I'm talking now, this is in prose, it's just regular lines. And what we read in the English translation was prose. But poetry is something different, right? Poetry is not just writing. Poetry means you take what is written and you put it in some form of verse or some form of meter, usually. Poetry is poetic. It has the intention to do more than just convey information. It's meant to pull the strings of the heart. Poetry, it, besides conveying what is said literally, it suggests other things that are not said, but implied, or felt, or heard in the poem. And so writing poetry is a whole different thing than writing just an essay, writing just prose. The ability of poetry to suggest something that's not present in Sanskrit poetics is called dhwani. Dhwani means suggestion, where something is deeply embedded in what's there, but not said directly. So, for example, the famous verse in Bhagavad Gita, 1866, Sarva dharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam braja aham tvam sarva papebhyo mokshayishyami ma shusha. So Krishna is saying, give up all varieties of dharma and seek shelter, refuge in me. So seek refuge in me is mam ekam, me alone, sharanam, refuge, vraja. Now the word vraja in Sanskrit, it comes from the root vraj, which means to go. So he's saying, go or come to me, go to my shelter. But the Vaishnava Acharyas, in the word vraja, they hear something else. Right? That Krishna is saying, go to vraja, go to Vrindavan. Mam ekam sharanam vraja. Seek my shelter in Vrindavan. Now, someone might say, well, grammatically, that's not there, right? It's in the wrong case. It's not the word. It's a different word altogether. But no one denies that, right? The commentators who are writing realize, of course, they know basic Sanskrit grammar. They understand the fact that that's not the word for Vrindavan there. And yet, that doesn't matter in this case because the suggestion is there. The dhwani is there. You hear something that may be implied by the poet, in this case the Lord himself, right, to those who are sensitive enough to hear it. Just like wine tasting. Have you read descriptions of wine before? I don't presume you've drunk it before, but have you ever read descriptions on a menu before of wine? Or something else where it says it has a slight woody taste to it with a hint of raspberry and some slight leftover lingering aroma at the end. You've read this before? The wine tasting is a science, right? Where they circulate the wine like this, aerate it, and then you smell it, and then you taste it a little bit. And these people taste all kinds of things in wine that definitely are not present there, right? There's no wood in it, there's no this, there's no that. But you feel it, you smell it. Or same thing they do with chocolate, right? Different flavors, different, or coffee, different kinds of beans and different good depth of flavor and all of this. It's scientifically speaking, you can't quantify it, but it's present. There's a hint there. Only if you're a connoisseur, only if you know what you're smelling, what you're tasting, right? And you have some expertise in this regard. So poetry is like that. For someone who has skill, who has ability, they can hear things that the poet wants you to hear, but doesn't want to say. Because sometimes saying something is not the best way of communicating it. We think that if I just go out and say it, then that person understands it. But sometimes you can say so much without saying anything, right? Just by using the eyes, the gesture of the eyes. If I look at you and I, you know, if I give you an angry expression, or I give you a loving expression, you can read so much into that without having to say anything. That's the power of poetry, or it's called kavya. Kavya. And those who write poetry are kavi. I'll give you one example. In Kalidasa's work, Kumara Sambhava. Kumara Sambhava is the birth of Kumara, Lord Shiva's son, besides Ganesha. And This is a poem that Prabhupada actually refers to several times in his lectures. It's a very wonderful piece of poetry. Kalidasa is one of the world's greatest poets. There's this one scene in which, so I won't repeat the whole story, but in the incident of Daksha and Sati, Sati eventually died. She immolates herself in fire as a result of insult. And Lord Shiva is very, very upset, very distressed as a result of his wife's death, departure. And so he goes into a state of deep meditation, draws himself into a cave, and cuts himself off from the world. Now, this is a big problem for the world because Lord Shiva and Sita, or Sati and Mother Parvati, they are the parents of this universe. Kalidasa begins his poem by saying, Jagata Pitaro Vande Parvati Parameshwaro. Lord Shiva and Mother Parvati, they give birth to this creation. We talked about this last year in the lecture on Shiva Tattva, if you remember. And so they're very upset, and they try to entice Lord Shiva to come out from his depression and pull him out from his cave and his austerities. Nothing works until they decide that the best way to get him out of his cave is to find him a wife, to find Sati again. And they do locate her. She has been reborn as Mother Parvati, daughter of the Himalayan mountains. And so they, all the sages, the rishis, they go as a delegation to Himalaya, to Himavan, to Mount Parvata, and her father to request his daughter's hand in marriage, as they go as the sort of the matchmaking party. And there they describe the glories, the qualities of Lord Shiva for his father to hear how wonderful of a groom he will make. But besides telling his father, they've got a secondary purpose, which is that Mother Parvati is standing right next to her father, and they want her to hear as well. So if her heart is attracted to Lord Shiva, then the deal is sealed. So there they are describing his wonderful qualities. And and as they finish describing these qualities, Kalidasa, the poet, he describes Parvati's reaction to hearing all these praises of Lord Shiva. And he says, how does it begin? Pitu Parshve Abhomukhi Leela Kamala Patrani Ganayam Asa Parvati. Okay? So the sages, as they were reciting the glories of Lord Shiva, Pitu Parshve Abhomukhi, Mother Parvati is standing next to her father. Pitu Parshve, next to her father, Abhomukhi, with her head down, looking downward because she's bashful. Okay, this is about her marriage and she's feeling shy. Pitu Parshve Adhomuhi Leela Kamala Patrani Ganayam Asa Parvati. And she's got a flower in her hand, a kamala, Leela Kamala, a flower to play with. And what she's doing, what is she doing with that flower? Ganayam Asa Parvati. She's counting the number of petals on the lotus. One, two, and this is, of course, what's the point of counting the petals on a lotus? And that too again and again. There is no point. So all the commentators, they explain that by saying this, that she's counting the petals on a lotus, she's doing something mindless like that. The poet is indicating that at this point, she falls in love with Lord Shiva, and she gives her heart to Lord Shiva. Because in Sanskrit poetry, it is commonly said that if a girl does something mindless like this, scratching the ground with her toenails, or fiddling with her hair, or counting the petals on a lotus, then she's emotionally affected, right? So they say, here we see, the poet is telling us, Mother Parvati, she gives her heart to Lord Shiva. Now, why like this? Because it's so much nicer to say it like this for the poet than to come out and say, oh, and she fell in love with Shiva. Because that's way too blunt for an emotion like love. This is why in Indian culture, in Vedic culture, and cultures all over the world, actually, traditional cultures, telling someone I love you is like a really crass thing to do, right? It's like hitting someone on the head with a hammer, right? Why would you say I love you? Can't you express it with your eyes? Can't you express it with your hands and your gestures? And can you express it with your behavior? Are there not so many ways of expressing the fact that you love someone? Do you really have to say it? So that's the idea behind poetry, behind kavya, right? Poetry does something that regular prose cannot do. It suggests something, elicits that emotion, and tells the reader, indicates to the reader, without ever having to say it directly. That is called dhwani, or suggestion, the power of poetry. Now, all of this to say that the Ramayana, if you read the Valmiki Ramayana, the first Ramayana, is called Adikavya, the first piece of poetry. And the very first time that the Ramayana was ever spoken was the Ramayana by Valmiki in Sanskrit. Something like 25,000 verses long, so quite large. The Mahabharata is not that long. It's not as long as the Mahabharata is. The Mahabharata is 100,000 verses long, so this is a quarter of the length. But still, 25,000 verses makes it easily one of the longest epics in the world. And written by Maharshi Valmiki. And the first Ramayana, that is by Valmiki Muni, was also the first piece of poetry in the world. And the first poem that was written, the first piece of verse that was written by Valmiki Muni, comes about in a very, very special way. This has to do with the birth of the Ramayana itself. Once upon a time, Valmiki Muni is going on a walk in the evening with his disciples. And as they're surveying the beautiful scene that's present all around, they notice all of a sudden an arrow whizzes by. They don't see who shot the arrow, but it whizzes past their shoulders and it hits a bird. But she's not alone. It hits two birds. Two cranes that are in love with each other. They're mating. And it hits one of them. I forget, the male or the female. I think it hits the male. And he dies. And the female, seeing her husband, her lover, having died, feels so much pain and so much grief that she too keels over and dies. And when Valmiki Muni sees this, and the sages that he's with see this, they're devastated. And Valmiki Muni particularly is so angry and he's so upset. He sees this horrible scene, and all this anger wells up in him. And he utters this curse. He says, Ma nishada pratishthantam agama shashvati sama yat kroncha mithunadekam avadhi kamamohitam. It means this. Ma nishada. O Nishada, O hunter, Ma Pratishthan Kvam, may you never have peace in this world. May you never be stable. agama shashvati sama, for an eternal number of years, right? Forever and ever and ever. May you never find peace in this world. Shashvati sama. Why? Yat krauncha mithunat ekam. Because avadhi kama mohita. Because you killed one amongst a pair of cranes. Krauncha mithuna. You killed one of them. Avadhi kama mohita. When they were completely absorbed, enchanted by desire, by love. He utters this curse and he goes home. And on his way home, he feels terrible. He feels horrible because he thinks, my God, what level of curse did I utter? I mean, the birds were shot by a hunter. I did not even see who the hunter was. And such a heavy curse. Of all things, I could have cursed him to die, right? But I cursed him with something worse, which is not to have peace anywhere he walks the earth. And he felt horrible and horrible and thought, you know, I succumbed to anger. This is so not sage-like. It's not proper. And as he's feeling worse and worse and worse, Lord Brahma appears on the scene. And he says, my son, don't worry. These words were not uttered by you. They were planted in your mouth by Goddess Saraswati herself. Because they are no ordinary words. Do you remember what you said exactly? And he remembers. And he says, listen carefully. Here you have spoken the first verse, the first shloka. Means what? That there is a metrical pattern to these words. It's not just a line, a sentence, but there's a pattern. Ma nishada pratishthantvam. Eight syllables per line. Ma nishada pratishthantvam agama shashvati sama yat krauncha mithunadekam avadhi kama mohitam. Eight syllables, four lines, 32 syllables altogether. This created the very first verse that you and I are so familiar with, because the entire Bhagavad Gita, almost, is in this meter. Sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam braja aham tvam sarva papebhyo mokshayishyami ma shucha satatam kirtayanto mam yatantascha drida vrata namasyantascha mam bhaktya nitya yukta upasate. You can count it. Eight syllables per line, 32 syllables total, in exactly the same pattern of laghu and guru, of long and short syllables. This creates meter, it creates a verse, it creates a pattern, and that pattern was the first time it was used, was with this verse from the Ramayana. So, Lord Brahma says, now that you have been given the first shloka, the reason, there's a very special reason for it. You need to use this shloka, this meter, this pattern, to write the story of Lord Ramachandra. A story that has not yet occurred. Lord Ram will appear on earth still. You will be present during that time. You will be the first sage to write this story. And forever so long as there are rivers that flow on this earth and mountains that stand on the surface of the earth, the story of the Ramayana will be told again and again and again. And you are the sage. You are the person designated to write this story. And so Valmiki Muni, he writes this story of the Ramayana before it ever occurs. He writes it down and he's got it already. When Love and Kush and Sita Devi come to his ashram, which we'll talk about tomorrow in the end, then he's got the whole story of the Ramayana, including the ending, ready for them to learn. Now, the commentators, particularly Govindaraja, he's a great commentator from the Sri Vaishnav tradition, he explains that the meaning of a story is entirely present in the first verse. So This is something that Sanskrit commentators talk about a lot, and I think I mentioned this in a prior seminar some years ago when we talk about the Bhagavad Gita. How the first verse of Bhagavad Gita, Dharma Kshetre, Kurukshetre, the acharyas, they see how the whole meaning of the Gita is present in the verse, first verse. So if this is the first verse of the Ramayana, then the acharyas, the commentators say, then the whole story must be present there. And in fact, it is. They reinterpret the verse, re-explain it, and the whole story of the Ramayana is there. Watch this. They say, Ma Nishada. Nishada means hunter. But Nishada also comes from the root, Sanskrit root, Sat, which means to sit. Ni means down, to sit down. Or resting place. Nishada means a resting place. Second meaning. Ma, what does Ma mean? Mind, what else? We use mother, yes, mother, Ma. Right? So Ma Nishada, the resting place of Ma, of Lakshmi. Okay? Ma here refers to Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune. Ma Nishada, the resting place of Lakshmi. Ma Nishada means Srinivasa. Same thing, Sri Lakshmi, Nivasa, resting place. Ma Nishada, Pratishtha. Pratishtha means peace or steadiness. It also means fame, prestige. Ma Nishada Pratishthantvam. May your fame be spread all over. Forever. Agama Shashwati Sama. For as many years as this world exists, your fame, O Srinivasa, O Lord Vishnu, will be present throughout this creation. Why? Yat Krauncha Mithunad Ekam. Because you killed Avadhi, one of the two, Krauncha Mithuna. Now, Krauncha Mithuna, what does it mean? The word Krauncha means crane. But also, Kruncha was the grandfather, I believe, of Mandodari, Ravana's wife. Okay? So, Krauncha refers to Mandodari. Krauncha Mithuna means Krauncha and her husband, the pair. So, Krauncha Mithuna, Ravana and Mandodari. Avadhi Kama Mohitam. You killed one of the two. Which one? Kama Mohitam. The one who was completely overcome by lust, by desire. In this case, not for Mandodari, for Sita. You killed one of the two. Therefore, may your fame be spread forever and ever and ever. So the whole Ramayana is present in this verse. But the other thing to keep in mind is that look at the circumstances for the birth of the Ramayana means what a terrible way for the first verse to be born, isn't it? It's the death of a very sad death of one of two birds who both love each other, and then all this anger from a sage. And so the great Sanskrit poet and commentator Ananda Vardhana, he wrote a book on poetry called Panyaloka. He says that in fact what this shows, this first verse of the Ramayana, that the primary emotion of the Ramayana, the primary feeling, the primary emotion of the Ramayana is what? What do you think it is?
Separation.
Anger, separation.
Tragedy.
Yeah, he says, shoka, grief. So, tragedy, you could say, or separation, lamentation. He says, that's the dominant emotion of the Ramayana. This is not a comedy. There may be some funny moments there, no doubt. Even a tragedy will have funny moments. It's not a tragedy in the classic Greek sense of the term. You know, like, you all studied Shakespeare's tragedies? Sometime in school, back in India, or here. So, tragedy in the English sense refers to a complete destruction, a meaningless end to the story, when everyone's killed and there's no meaning left. So it's not a tragedy in that sense, because it's a very meaningful tragedy. But the point is, the emotion is still very much one of grief, of lamentation. Have you ever thought about that in the story of the Ramayana? How sad the story is?
means every turn it's miserable. So Lord Ramachandra grows up as a very happy child. In a very happy childhood, he has four brothers. How many stories do you know of Lord Ramachandra's childhood as a baby? Practically nothing, right? Maybe one here, maybe one there. It's not like Krishna's childhood. We know all these stories and the demons and so on. All those happy years, very, very quickly in Balakanda. Very quickly. And the first major incident that you read about, you hear about, Vishwamitra taking away Lord Ramachandra. And right away, it's indicating the separation from Dashrath that's about to come. And then, at that point, you get one of the happiest moments in the whole story, which is Sita Swayambhar, Lord Ram's marriage to Mother Sita. It's practically the best part. And then you go on, and again, they come back to the kingdom. Everyone's so happy. Lord Ramachandra is going to be king. Mother Sita is going to be queen. They're going to be coronated. Oops, what happens? They get banished to the forest. 14 years in exile. And so much difficulty back home as a result. Maharaj Dashrath loses his life in grief. All the mothers are deeply saddened. Bharat is devastated. 14 years they spent in exile. And time is ending near, 13 years are over, and what happens? Mother Sita gets kidnapped. Lord Ram fights this huge battle to get her back. They fight the battle, he's victorious. She comes back home, they all return to Ayodhya. Victoriously, Diwali is celebrated, and they're coronated king and queen. And they live happily ever after. Ramayana says that Ram and Sita rule happily for 2 years. 2 years. And then Mother Sita is banished. And Lord Ram rules for 10,000 years, or 12,000 years. 12,000 years. In a state of deep personal sadness. Of course, he's the perfect king, so no one in the kingdom is unhappy. But he's very unhappy. He's very sad. We'll talk about this more tomorrow. And then the citizens feel remorse. They call Mother Sita back. She returns. And then she disappears again into the earth. And Lord Ram loses her again. Where's the happily ever after ending? It's not there. The story of the Ramayana is not there. In fact, how many times does Lord Ramachandra lose Mother Sita in the story of the Ramayana?
At least
three times at least, right? First time?
Kidnapping
by Ravana. Second time?
Banishment
by Lord Ramachandra. Third time?
Disappears.
She disappears into the earth. Three times the Lord is torn away from his beloved. Three times. And each time it happens, it's worse than the previous time. The first time he loses her, he goes practically mad with grief. And we'll talk about this in detail. But the second time, it's even worse because he has to do it. It's not, she's not being kidnapped. And the third time, it's even worse because she decides to go. Right? So each time it gets worse and worse and worse. And you read the story of the Ramayana and you think, oh my dear, what's the point here? Like, is this what our relationship with God is going to be like? Is this what the Lord's Leela is like? So much pain and so much separation and so much suffering. What can we learn? Why? Why is the story of the Ramayana so sad, so depressing? Yes? Yes, so there is the story of the curse. Yes. So there are reasons for every detail of the story, no doubt. But what's the larger lesson that we need to learn? The material world, there is suffering again and again. Good.
And there is separation also.
And there's separation. So it says, Bhagavatam says that people come together and are separated like leaves and twigs come together in the flow of a river, and then the river separates them again. Good. So the temporariness of this world, what else? What else is the Ramayana teaching us through all this shoka or all this grief? Yeah.
This life is full of sorrows.
This life is full of sorrows. Good. What else? Yeah.
Lord comes to the material world to teach others by his leela, how to sacrifice, how to be a good son, how to be a good husband, how to be a good king, and how to sacrifice his personal, you know, happiness for others.
Excellent. Very good. So the Lord shows the extent to which we have to go to perform our duty and how much sacrifice we have to perform to be a good person, to sacrifice, to be a good son, to be a good husband, to be a good king, and so on, to be a good father. Excellent. So the Lord is showing that to everyone. What else?
This relationship, how we maintain our relationship between each other.
How we make good, how we maintain relationships with each other. Yes?
Nothing stays for you ever.
Nothing stays for you ever, exactly. Everything is torn away. Good, yes.
Miseries are everywhere.
Miseries are everywhere. Terrific. There's one more reason, one more big reason. Yes, in the back.
Truth and honesty.
Truth and honesty, good. Moral qualities. Yes.
Exemplify the principle of harm, the principle of duty.
The principle of duty, excellent, dharma. Yeah.
By his own example, he shows how tragically one suffers when one is very attached to the spouse. Or
yes, so how we suffer as a result of attachment in the material world. There's one more big reason that he's showing all this
separation
pain.
Is the fact that he was separated from Mother Sita.
Yes.
And that is a factor in everybody's life.
Yes, that's a factor in everyone's life. But what about in the Lord's life?
Yes.
Just like how we get separated with our family, we should get separated. We should always be with the Lord.
Yes. So our relationship with the Lord, exactly, in separation. So Prabhupada, in one very nice purport, in fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, okay? This is in the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. I don't know. Where's the main story of the Ramayana in Bhagavatam? Anyone know?
Ninth
canto, right? Now, in the fifth canto, why is there reference to Lord Ram? Do you know? Fifth canto is generally what? What does fifth canto talk about in Bhagavatam? Someone said something here. Planetary systems, yes. It's cosmology. It's the universe, it's the world, the planetary system. In that, there are prayers by the Lord to the Lord by different leaders of different worlds, right? Different regions of this universe. And one of these regions is Kim Purusha Varsha. Kim Purusha Varsha is the land where the Kim Purushas live. Now, the word Kim Purusha is a very interesting word in Sanskrit. The word Purusha means what?
Male.
Male, man, or human being in general, right? So, and Kim means what? It's a question mark. So Kim Purusha means what? A man? And it's referring to people who are kind of like human beings, but not exactly. Namely, the great Vanaras, or monkeys. What? A man? And the leader in that land of Kim Purusha Varsha is Hanumanji. And there, in that section of Bhagavatam, he offers these beautiful prayers to Lord Ramachandra. And in one of these prayers, in the purport, Prabhupada describes three different levels of understanding, three layers of understanding that we get from the story of the Ramayana. Depending on where we are at, there's something for us to learn. The first level of understanding we get is we have to do our duty in this world no matter how difficult it is, as you said. No matter how tough it is. If you're a husband, you need to protect your wife and your family, even if it means building a bridge across the ocean. Okay? So that's what we have to do. If we take a vow at marriage, you know, for in life and in death, in sickness and in health, then this is what we have to do. And Lord Ramachandra showed it. We may not have to build a bridge across the ocean. We might have to go to work when we don't want to or whatever. But we have to do our duty. If our parents are there, we have to take care of them. And we have to do our duty properly. Even if it's difficult. Even if it means 14 years in exile in the forest. The story of the Ramayana is a story of sacrifice for the purpose of duty, of dharma. And everyone's doing the sacrifice, not just Lord Ramachandra. Lakshman is doing a huge sacrifice. You know, he spent 14 years, Ramayana says, without sleep. Because in the day, of course, he was moving out and about with Lord Ram and Sita as they traveled, protecting them, serving them. At night, he was guard. And so for 14 years, he took not a wink of sleep. That was his duty. He's sacrificing so much as a matter of duty. Hanumanji is sacrificing so much for his duty, jumping across oceans, lifting mountains. Lord Ramachandra is spending 14 years in the forest. He's killing a whole army of demons, building a bridge across the ocean to just do his duty as husband, to do his duty as son. That's the first level. Do your duty, your dharma in this world. The second level, so that's the first level is for the average person. Anyone should learn from that, all of us. We have to do our dharma. But for people who are a bit more advanced and trying to achieve spiritual life, spiritual advancement, and progress back to God, the story of the Ramayana gives the opposite message that several of you have said. That if you become entangled in the material world and become attached to wife and to husband and to children and to wealth and to kingdom, look at how much you're going to have to suffer. Look at all of the trouble that comes. So better don't get married. Stay brahmachari. Because who wants all this trouble? If the Lord himself had to go through this trouble, we can't escape, right? It's not going to be easy for us. We can't think. The story of the Ramayana is meant to teach us, right? Not to think, well, Lord Ramachandra had a tough time because he was God. But I'm a human being, so I'm going to have a great time. That doesn't make any sense, right? Not at all. No, life is going to be even more difficult for me. Because I don't have the ability to kill every demon I see. They might end up killing me. What do I do then, right? There's pain, there's suffering in this world. And we have to be aware of that if we want to go back to God. It should cultivate detachment in us, right? So the first level is saying, do your duty, stay attached, as in do your duty. Mm-hmm. The second level is saying, become detached. What's the point of all of this? You're going to suffer. The third level is the highest. This is for those who are already the Lord's pure devotees, who in the Lord's pastimes, as Lord Ramachandra, they experience, they taste with the Lord the greatest spiritual emotion, which is vipralamba or viraha bhakti, service to the Lord in separation. The remembrance of the Lord in separation is even more powerful and greater than it is in union. We know the story of Lord Krishna. Sometimes people criticize Lord Krishna. 12, 13 years he spent in Vrindavan, captured everyone's heart and then left. And he never came back for so long. Could he not come back? Was that not nice of him? But the separation that the gopis and the residents of Vrindavan felt for Lord Krishna, that separation brought Krishna even closer to them. Even more close than if when Krishna was actually present. Service and separation, we know this from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we know this from many of our acharyas, is so much greater and deeper than is service and union. Because when someone is not present, then your remembrance of them, your memory of them grows even deeper and even stronger. And you cannot bear the thought of being away from them. It's perhaps the only experience we have of such things in this world is when a mother is separated from a very, very small child, right, who she loves, and somehow, by some horrible circumstance, she's been separated from that child. The way in which she cries and her heart just breaks apart for that child. Or when two people, newlyweds, when they are separated from each other, right? After a while, after marriage, it kind of cools down a bit. You're happy to, okay, you go on vacation on your own. I'll follow later, right? So it changes. But in the early stages of marriage, oh my God, where is he? Where is she? I can't be away even for a moment. That type of intensity doubles when that separation happens, right? It becomes even more. But the difference is in the material world, that separation is only a cause of pain. If you ever see a baby calf torn away from her mother, right, the amount of pain that that mother cow goes through is so great, it's directly proportioned to the love that she has for the calf. In fact, the cow's love for the calf is, according to the scriptures, it's a model for motherly love. Actually, the cow sets the standard for motherly love, if you see that relationship. This is why Krishna, one of Krishna's names is Bhakta
Vatsala.
Vatsala means?
Calf.
Vatsa means calf, right? He who treats the devotees like a mother cow would. So nice. So, like a calf, that amount of suffering, you see, it's only suffering. That's all it is, right? When that calf is torn away from the mother, only suffering. But in a spiritual context, that separation is, Prabhupada explains in one purport, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is the greatest poison mixed with the greatest nectar. It is so poisonous and so bitter that you cannot dare swallow that pill. But it is so sweet you cannot stop it. It's like Prabhupada's definition of good chutney, you know? Prabhupada's definition of good chutney is too hot to eat, too sweet to resist. Right? That should be chutney. You can't eat it because every bite makes your mouth burn. But you can't stop eating it because it's so sweet, it's so good. This is chutney. So this is the relationship of viraha, of suffering. It's like poison mixed with nectar. Or another example Prabhupada gives is hot sugarcane juice. This is something I don't have too much experience of. Anyone in India have this experience? If you drink hot sugarcane juice, apparently it's very good, then it burns your mouth, because sugarcane juice gets very hot and it burns your mouth, but it's so sweet and so good you can't stop drinking it. So that experience of viraha, of vipralamba, it draws the Lord and his devotee even closer than they already are. And that is the highest form of emotion that a devotee can experience in relation to the Lord. To taste that relationship is why the Lord does these leelas in the form of Lord Ramachandra. You see, he has his own agenda. He's teaching the world, do your dharma. He's teaching the aspiring devotees, don't get attached. And for himself and his close associates, he's tasting the flavor of separation. And how much separation is there in the Ramayana? Already, we've talked about how Ramachandra and Sita Devi are separated 3 times. But there's separation everywhere in the Ramayana, even in other relationships. Where else do we find the devotees experiencing this intense, intense feeling of separation from the Lord? Lord Maharaj Dashrath in Ramachandra, right? He gives up his life in grief. Bharat, right? He is so devastated at the end. His position is actually really difficult. Because not only does he pine for Lord Ramachandra, not only is he so upset at what has happened to Lord Ram, but he has to enjoy the benefits of it. Right? So his mother did it for him. So it's all the more he feels guilty about this. Now I have to sit on the throne when I already feel guilty about the fact that Lord Ramachandra has left, and I feel so much separation from him. I have to enjoy the fruits of that. It makes him feel all the more horrible. And he tells Lord Ramachandra that 14 years of exile to the day, right? If you're one day late, you will not find Bharata. You will find my dead body here. This is going to be over. So 14 years, I understand, is your promise. But no longer, no more than that at all. And he rules with Lord Ramachandra's sandals. The union of Ram and Bharat, Ram Bharat Milan, is one of the greatest high points of the story of the Ramayana. So his separation, his mood of separation, 14 years, is heart-wrenching. Dashrath and Lord Ram, Bharat and Lord Ram. Who else?
Vibhishan.
In what way?
He has to separate from his brother.
Yes, he has to separate from his brother, right, Ravana. But he also has to live his whole life in separation from Lord Ramachandra in very difficult circumstances. He's a great devotee of Lord Ram. And it says in the Ramayana that Vibhishan lives in Lanka like the tongue lives between the teeth. Think about that. At any moment, the tongue can be bitten, right? And somehow it just escapes by this much. And occasionally when it doesn't, oh, it's so painful. So really, really bad. So Ramayana says he's living in Lanka like the tongue lives between the teeth. Like that, on his toes all the time. He's surrounded by demons. Right? New Jersey is great in comparison. Shabri, yes. Excellent. So Shabri spends her whole life. And you know, her guru tells her, her guru says, Ramayana describes, that she's living all these years, she serves her spiritual master faithfully. It's an amazing story. People don't realize. They just know the Beda part. You know, she's biting into it and beating the Lord. But there's actually a very powerful moral in the story of Shabari, where she's serving her spiritual master very, very faithfully until the day the spiritual master departs this world. He gives up his body. And before he leaves, he asks her, he says, you've served me so well, tell me, what do you want? And she says, I just want to have darshan of my Lord, that's all. And he promises, he says, you will see him. You wait right here and prepare for his arrival. And do you know how many years she waits? Years and years and years she waits, and every day she prepares the path for the Lord's arrival. She lays out the flowers. She lays out the food. And every day, the Lord disappoints her. He doesn't come. And until she's a very, very, very old lady. And one fine day, Lord Ramachandra shows up. And she's overjoyed as a result of the Lord's arrival. At first, she doesn't even recognize the Lord. But soon she does. And that hope that she always held, that the Lord will come, was only because of faith in the instruction of her spiritual master. It's a very big lesson. Because she had otherwise no reason to think that the Lord would come. It's not just that she's some, you know, really emotional woman who doesn't have a clue and just thinks God will come. You know, she's often portrayed like that. Like she's just, you know, just emotional and that's it. And so she doesn't know what she's doing. She actually has a lot of knowledge. A knowledge born from service and hearing to her spiritual master. And as a result of that firm conviction, she thinks, my guru has promised me that fruit will come to bear. Even if I'm 90 years old, it doesn't matter. And one day the Lord walks with his own feet into her ashram. She sees the Lord and she goes straight to Vaikuntha. Right? So separation, her whole life was sent to spend in separation for one moment's darshan. That's all. Few minutes, right? 1 hour maybe, that's all. Good. Who else in separation?
Ahilya and Gautam.
Ahilya and Gautam, yes. The stone.
Sita and Ram.
Sita and Ram. Kekai and Bharat, good. Lakshman and Urmila, right? So Sita Devi is doing her austerities by going to the forest and saying, I'm going to stick with you and I'm going to bear the thorns and the demons and everything. That's my duty. And we think, oh, the story of the Ramayana is telling us that the wife should follow the husband. But look at what Urmila is doing. She's also being a faithful wife, but in a completely different way. She's doing her duty by staying back home. Why?
Because if she is there, Lakshman would not be able to serve properly.
Yes. So Lakshman can serve Lord Ramachandra without any worries himself. She says, look, I'll be comfortable here, I'll be safe, you can focus on your service. If you have to take care of me, then there needs to be someone else to take care of you, right, the two of us. Just like you're going to take care of Ram and Sita, it doesn't work. So she stays, and for 14 years, she is separated from her husband.
Bharat and Mandavi.
Yes. yes. And Bharat and Mandavi also.
Yes. Ram Hanuman.
Sumitra, yes.
The citizen of Ram and Hanuman.
Lord Ram and Hanuman, yes. Hanuman spends his whole life waiting for Lord Ramachandra to arrive in Kishkindha. Right? Again, waiting and waiting. The citizens of Ayodhya, there were a few who had some misconceptions, but these citizens were deeply devoted to their Lord. And in the end, Ramayana says, they all went to Vaikuntha in their own bodies, self-same bodies. It means they are the Lord's eternal associates, because obviously we can't go in these bodies. They're the Lord's eternal associates, and they're separated from the Lord for 14 years. In fact, every relationship that you see in the Ramayana, almost every relationship, is a relationship of separation. It's, the Lord is experiencing this one emotion, viraha bhakti, vipralamba bhava, so powerfully in the Ramayana, again and again and again. He's tasting it, he's savoring it. And if you study the Srimad Bhagavatam's account of the Ramayana in Canto 9, Bhagavatam is dealing almost exclusively with levels 2 and 3 of the Tora of the Ramayana. Means the first level of dharma, Shukadeva Goswami does not even mention, practically speaking. Because that's what everyone gets from the story of the Ramayana. Do your duty. Okay. So you already understand that. In fact, he tells Maharaj Parikshit, he says, I'm going to tell you the story of Ramayana in brief because you've already heard it many, many times, he says. Think about it. This is 5,000 years ago. And already the story is like, yeah, I grew up listening to the story, so yeah. I know it. So he says, I'll be brief. But you know the things he focuses on is these two morals. Look at the result of attachment in the material world. Look at how much suffering it causes. And number two, look at the relationship between the Lord and his devotees. When that relationship is at its most intense, when that sugar cane juice is really hot, when that chutney is too hot to eat, look at that relationship, how great and how intense it is. That's a level that is difficult for us to appreciate. But we can at least theoretically understand. This is why the Lord is going through this. It's not misery for him. It is in one way, but in another way, it's his opportunity to be so close to his devotees. Just like Lord Krishna left Vrindavan in the same way. And this is, of course, the mood of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also, that he's coming to teach viraha or vipralamba, how to love the Lord in separation as the highest form of love for the Lord. Ashtishiva padaratam pirashtumam adarshanan marmahatam karutva yatha tatha vavidhatulam vato matpranathastu sayeranam. He says, no one else but you is my Lord. Even if adarshanan, you don't show yourself to me, marmahatam, you make me brokenhearted. Yatha tatha vavidhatulam vato. O debauchee, you can do whatever you like with me. O immoral character, you can do whatever you like. Because you are my Lord unconditionally. Nahara, no one else. So this is three different levels of the Ramayana story and what we can grasp from it. Now I'm going to pause here for just a few minutes to see if anyone has any questions up to this point in terms of the Ramayana, and then we'll continue for our related time. Yes.
You mentioned about there are different Ramayanas performed in Japan and in other countries. So
yes.
Do they follow Judaism or do they follow the Christianity and still?
So originally those cultures were, so Thailand, Southeast Asia essentially, was they were Hindu areas. They were influenced by Hinduism from the kings of South India who had links of trade over the sea to Southeast Asia. So historically speaking, before Islam came to, before it was born, these areas were Hindu in their culture. But even as they have become Muslim or Christian or so on, they have retained their most loved and favorite stories of the Ramayana. And they continue to perform them even in though some have become Buddhist, some have become Muslim, and some have become Christian, still the story of the Ramayana is still very much loved and told. Yes?
Many times people say that, yes, Lord Ramayana is an example of how we should lead our lives. But that time it was Lord Ram, and his character was exactly. Today you don't have husbands who are like Ram.
Yes.
You don't have parents like Dashrath. What would you say to them?
Does yes.
Still apply?
Yes. The answer is yes. The story of the Ramayana definitely does still apply. But at the same time, when we apply the story in our own lives, then we have to make adjustments as is appropriate to our current time and our current context. This is the case not just with Ramayana, but with Shastra or scripture in general. That what is written in Shastra is the absolute truth that is eternal, right? Assuming the Shastra is aporushe, it's infallible. But how it's applied is based on context and based on circumstance and based on the time and situation. Whether we are reading Gita or Bhagavatam or Ramayana, this is true, right? It needs to be applied appropriately in our own lives and adjusted to the degree that we can follow that advice. So that application process is where guru and sadhu come into the picture, right? Where the spiritual master and the community of devotees, including the acharyas who comment on these works, they guide us on how best to apply what is an ideal model to our own lives, which are so much less than ideal. So that translation process has to happen between the two. We, none of us are Ram, none of us are Sita, none of us are Dashrath. At the same time, that should not be an easy excuse for saying, therefore nothing is relevant to me. Because we can certainly learn the lessons we have to learn, apply it to the degree that our conviction and faith allows us, and to the degree that it is appropriate in the age of Kali that we live in. And that application process is the whole process of bhakti, right? That is how we progress in bhakti, is taking these various aspects and saying, well, this is how I need to apply in our own lives. Different scriptures will teach also different principles at different times for different kinds of audiences. So we described three different kinds of audiences here. But Krishna Lila is teaching something a little different for a different kind of audience as well, a different level of advancement. So all of that needs to be taken into account when we apply Shastra in our own lives. So context is very important, but just because context is important doesn't make Shastra irrelevant. In fact, it makes it even more relevant. The very fact that Shastra can be applied in India and in New Jersey and in Canada and in China, and it can be applied today, and it could be applied 1,000 years ago, and it can be applied by our great-grandchildren in the future, that's what makes Shastra eternal, makes it absolute. That's what gives it its glory. It doesn't take away, it actually, that is the relevance of scripture.
Yes. Valmiki Muni, it is written, few places I read, and he came as Tulsidas. And Tulsidas Ramayana is mostly read, and that really cast people to become devotees of Lord Ramchandra,
yeah,
from India and other places.
Yeah.
So how do you compare these two scriptures, and did really Valmiki Muni came as Tulsidas?
Yes. So many people say like that. There are many different opinions on Tulsidas Ramayana also. Prabhupada, basically, what he says in regard to Tulsidas Ramayana, he regards Tulsidas as a great sage. He often lists him in lists of different poets and sages and great devotees. So he has a lot of respect for Tulsidas Ramayana. But whenever there is a disagreement in terms of the lila or in terms of the moral of the story or the content, then Valmiki Ramayana is the standard, right? So with the Valmiki Ramayana, we can't go wrong. It's the original Ramayana given by this by Maharshi Valmiki in the very presence of Lord Ramachandra. And it's been commented and passed down by sages for thousands of years. Right? Even academic Western scholars say that the Ramayana is at least 2,500 years old, right? Which makes it, by far the oldest Ramayana in anywhere in the world, and one of the oldest texts in the history of the world, period, right? So, as it is, the Valmiki Ramayana is very trustworthy. Tulsidas Ramayana Prabhupada explains that Tulsidas Goswami, he specifically calls it Ramcharit Manas, right? And the word Manas means lake, but it also means the meditations or one's own realizations about Ramayana. So Prabhupada says, he explains that Ramcharit Manas is technically not, objectively speaking, the story of Ramayana or the story of Lord Ram. It is Tulsidas Goswami's realizations and feelings about the story of Lord Ramachandra, right? So it's his realizations, for which it's very valuable, because he's a great devotee, a pure devotee of Lord Ramachandra. But at the same time, for that reason, the gold standard is Valmiki Ramayana. And so it's important that we study Valmiki Ramayana whenever we can, because our own local, in North India, Tulsidas Ramayana is immensely popular. In South India, in different languages, in different regions, other Ramayanas are very popular. In Thailand, it's the Ramakien, which is their own version of the Ramayana, very popular. So there's nothing wrong in enjoying the Ramayana in one's own language, in one's own style. These are all very nice. But at the same time, it's very important that we familiarize ourselves with the original. Because sometimes the misconceptions we get and the criticisms we get about Lord Ramachandra come from various kinds of versions that we've heard here and there. Or we've heard through folk stories, or we've heard from our grandmother. And there's nothing wrong with that, but when there comes a doubt and when there comes reason for criticism, then we have to go back to the original to see what is actually there in Valmiki Ramayana. Yes?
But it is the Vipralamba Bhava which you explained, right?
Yes.
Even in Krishna Leela, you could see the Vipralamba Bhava kind of is manifested in both Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, and Madhurya relationship.
Yes.
Whereas in Ram Leela, it looks like Vipralamba Bhava is more kind of comes out in Dasya, Sakya, and Vatsalya. So, but it comes out more tragic than the Krishna Leela. I think that's where the confusion arises.
Yes, yes. Yes, it's a good point. I mean, in Krishna Leela also, that Vipralamba Bhava is there. But there's big chunks of Krishna's story where that is not in focus, right? Whereas in the Ramayana, it's always in focus, this Vipralamba Bhava. And this is why Ananda Vardhana says that the dominant emotion is shoka, is grief, right? There's no doubt about it. And for a long time, I used to feel really disturbed reading the Ramayana, thinking, this is so sad. This is the Lord's Leela. It should be joyful. What's wrong, you know? And when I realized that actually so many people and so many acharyas and Srila Prabhupada and everyone is pointing to this fact, then you think, okay, there's a big lesson here. You know, I really cannot appreciate Vipralamba Bhav. Unfortunately, all it seems to me to be is suffering. But if the Lord and his devotees are saying that this is actually great joy as well, then I have to accept it, right? I have to say, okay, this is beyond my pay grade, right? I can't taste this, I can't accept this. So let me at least understand the lower levels, right? That the material world is a place of suffering and attachment will lead to suffering, so let us become detached and serve the Lord. Or let me perform my duty nicely given my responsibilities. In fact, this reaction is so common that even in Chaitanya Leela, right, Mahaprabhu is traveling South India and he meets this Brahmana who is so distressed he can't eat or he can't sleep properly. He's just crying nonstop. Why? How could Ravana take away Mother Sita? How could he do that? And what right does he have to take away Mother Sita? And he invites the Lord to his home for prasad, and yet he cannot serve him properly because he's so distressed, so miserable. So imagine the Lord's compassion and how much the Lord cares. He's touring through South India and he comes to the, the Adikeshava temple, the same place where he found the Brahma Samhita. He finds a manuscript of the Kurma Purana. And in the Kurma Purana, it says that, in fact, Ravana did not kidnap Mother Sita at all. He took a Maya Sita, a Sita that was created just for this purpose. In other words, she multiplied herself, and all he got was not the Lord's internal energy, which no demon can ever touch, right? But the Lord's external energy, Maya Devi, who is basically what we try to enjoy in this material world. And when he grabs her, it's that. And when she goes through the Agni Pariksha, which we'll talk about tomorrow, when she goes through the Agni Pariksha, Agni Dev returns the original Sita, and the Maya Sita is burnt, is finished in the Agni, in the fire. Right? And he comes, returns the original Sita to Lord Ramachandra. Lord Ramachandra is so happy to see this, and he remembers that Brahmana, who is suffering so much, that in one place in Chaitanya Charitamrita, it says he tears those pages out of the Purva Purana and takes them. But later on, Krishnadas Kaviraj clarifies, he doesn't tear them. He asks that a copy be made of the Purva Purana. But what's interesting is he requests that the original he can take, the old one, and he leaves the newer copy at the temple. Why? Because he's worried that this Brahmana will not believe him. He'll think, oh, this is some newfangled scripture that you created. So he needs to show the old pages, the original. So he takes the old pages to the Brahmana, and the Brahmana is so happy, so happy. Oh, he finally gets some relief, and he can eat and sleep. And then he invites the Lord to lunch again. He says, I'm so sorry that first time around, I really messed things up. I didn't feed you properly. I'm much happier now. Come to my home for lunch. And he serves the Lord a very nice meal. So this is the experience, in fact, of many, many, many devotees, of this fact that the Ramayana is a very difficult story to digest in some way. Right? It's a very sad story. And yet, even we know, at some level, there's something very sweet about it. Right? Because if it was just a sad or depressing story, we would not tell the story again and again and again. Right? It would not become so popular all over the world. It's not something you would want to tell your grandkids if it was just a horrible, sad story. That means even we can feel that that chutney is also sweet, right? Mostly we feel the hot, but we can feel there's some sweet there. We can experience it. And so we tell the story of the Ramayana again and again. Because the love of the Lord's devotees for him really comes out in separation better than it comes out in any other one. You can see it in the Ramayana. The way in which they behave, and the way the Lord cries for his own devotees. This is another thing. In Krishna Lila, you don't hear so much about how Krishna misses the residents of Vrindavan. But in Ram Lila, you see how much, it's not just the devotees missing the Lord. It's the Lord crying for the devotees. Do you know how many times Maharshi Valmiki stops in the middle of the story to say, Lord Ramachandra was at Kishkindha, living in a cave, waiting for Sugriva and so on. And one day he had a terrible day, where he saw the beauty of autumn. The rainy season had just finished. And seeing the beauty of the autumn season and the lotuses blooming, his heart again began pining for Mother Sita. And again, he just broke down in tears and cried and cried and cried and cried. And Lakshman had to help him and support him through that. Lord Ramachandra cries so many buckets of tears in the Ramayana. And I'm not exaggerating here. If you read, it's like bashpa, the word for tear into bashpa, ashru. Valmiki Muni is just using it again and again and again. The Lord's crying here, he's crying there. You know all these images of Lord Ramachandra as this macho, chauvinistic man who mistreats his wife? Not there in the Ramayana. He cries more tears than any sensitive man today would want to cry. Right? More tears than anyone would cry, man or woman. All in separation from his devotees. Mother Sita, his brother Bharat, Lakshman, when he loses Lakshman at the end. I don't know if you know, he banishes Lakshman just like he banishes Sita. Right? So all of this we'll talk about tomorrow. Too much to talk about tomorrow. But it's very, you'll see, he's so pained. And so that's another thing you can appreciate in the Ramayana, even more than Krishna Lila, if you read Valmiki Ramayana, is how much the Lord misses his devotees. It's not just the devotees feeling separation from the Lord. Krishna, or Lord Ramachandra, is also in so much pain. And the grief he feels when he hears of his his father's passing away, and when he hears of Bharat's austerities, and when he hears of Lakshman and everything he's gone through, and the tears he cries when he thinks of Hanuman's sacrifice for him, and the gratitude and the tears that Mother Sita cries when she thinks of Hanuman's sacrifice for her. It just goes on and on. The Lord's grief for his devotees. So in that way, the story really demonstrates that love, that relationship between Krishna and his devotees, between Lord Ram and his devotees, better than any story of union could. Right? That separation highlights it. Oh my, okay.
In terms of origin of Ramayana, it's also said that's the Itihasis too, right? Mahabharata, I mean, so is there a connection there?
Yes, Vyasadeva gave the Itihasas as in he gave Mahabharata. Okay. He's the author of Mahabharata, but not of the Ramayana. Okay, he's presenting all the Vedas in the sense that he organizes them and gives them to different rishis, different disciples to carry on and to teach. But he's not the author of everything. So he's not the author of the Vishnu Purana, that's written by his father, Parashara Muni. He's not the author of Ramayana, that's written by Valmiki Muni. So there's a few things he's not the author of. He's actually technically not the author of the Vedas. He's only writing down the Vedas, which have been revealed to different rishis much before Vyasadeva's time. So therefore he's called Vyasa, he who divides, he who compiles, he who edits the Vedas. But he's the author of Mahabharata, Vedanta Sutra, Srimad Bhagavatam.
What about 18 Puranas?
Most of them. Most of them. Vishnu Purana not, but most of them, yes.
So from a timing perspective, Mahabharata is there before Ramayana?
Mahabharata is much later. Right? Much later. So Vyasadeva is writing the Mahabharata 5,000 years ago, around the time of Lord Krishna's appearance. In fact, it's the same time pretty much. He's, like Valmiki Muni, he's writing the story and he's a character in the story, both. Vyasadeva is there and he's with Shantanu and his he's there through the whole story. Sanjay is giving on. But same thing with Ramayana. Valmiki Muni is both a character in the story and the author of the story. Except this is happening in Treta Yuga, so some 2 million years ago. So much older than the story of the Mahabharata. And therefore, even in the Mahabharata, the story of the Ramayana is told. Just like in Bhagavatam. So there's a section of the Mahabharata called the Ramopakhyana, the story of Rama. And I forget who tells the story to whom. It's a very nice version of the Ramayana. In fact, just about every Purana and every scripture has a Ramayana within it. Because the Ramayana is so old, it doesn't matter how old any other scripture is, they tell the story of the Ramayana first. So very, very ancient poem. Yes.
You said there are three levels of understanding. Prabhupada says, right? The second is for those who are spiritually advanced.
Yes. Or trying to get
Yes.
So, very nice. So the question was, if the second layer of what we learn from the Ramayana, first layer is do your duty, right? And the second layer is how attachment to this material world causes suffering. So we should be detached. How do we apply that in our daily lives where we see that we are so attached to family and friends and so on, and our whole life goes in this huge rush of trying to do everything? How can we cultivate that detachment? So, essentially, it's a combination of the first and second levels. We do our duty in this world. Okay, we do our duty faithfully, just as faithfully as Lord Ramachandra did, to the best of our ability. We do our duty, but with an exit strategy in mind. Okay, so we understand that doing these duties is not the goal of my life. Sure, I need to get married, and therefore I need to be a good husband, and I need to be a good father, and I need to be a good son, and so on. But all of these relationships will be taken away from me at one point. So what is my exit strategy? Right? When the train comes to the last station, will I be thrown off the train or will I step off? That's the question, right? Because the point of detachment, the second layer, is not an option. It's a reality. It means you will become detached from family, whether you like it or not. Because if you don't do it willingly, death will do it for you forced, right? Or even before death, a relationship can be broken in so many ways, right? And we see this. Families are sources of great happiness. They're also sources of great, great misery, right? Because someone will mistreat us, we won't get along with someone, our relationship will be broken, we'll feel insulted. So many things can happen. That will happen. If not now, a little later, if not later, at death. So the question is, am I going to be thrown off the plane, the train? Am I going to be evicted from my apartment because I have overstayed my lease, and so I'm going to wait till the police come and throw my things out onto the curb and throw me onto the curb? Or will I make a plan to move? Will I find another apartment before it's too late? That is essentially level two. We have to do our duties in this world, but with an exit strategy in mind. And husband and wife need to make that exit strategy together. Right? This is not something that, I didn't tell my wife I'm taking sannyas next year. Right? That's not how we do it. It's the idea is both husband and wife have to walk this path together, like Ram and Sita did, despite the thorns. Yes, we're so committed to each other. We will walk through the forest and through the thorns together, and we'll fight off all these demons we have. Right? We'll do it. But what's our exit strategy? How will we become ultimately detached from this world and attached to Krishna? So that is a plan that we need to make, just like we do long-term planning for retirement. So we have to do long-term planning for material retirement. How can I become spiritually committed by the end of my life? And what are the steps that we are going to take from enjoying this material world and this material body 100%? How are we going to gradually move it down to 90, to 80, to 70, to 60, to 50? Right? Today, we're eating pizzas and we're eating enchiladas, but next year, no enchiladas, only pizzas, right? And the year after that, no pizzas. So that kind of step-by-step-by-step approach we have to take together with whoever we are attached to. It might be with our husband or wife. It might be with our children. If we don't learn how to become detached from our children, one day we'll have to force to be detached. Right? Or they will tell us in so many words that... that can happen. And when it happens, then we'll feel, oh, how did this happen? And I wanted to stay here and direct their life, and they don't want me to direct their life. What's wrong? I directed your life all the way up to this point. No, this is the news that the Ramayana is giving us. Right? At some point, every relationship is going to become a cause for suffering if we do not find an exit strategy in advance. That's not depressing. It's not sad. It's just good planning. That's all it is, right? This is why what Fidelity and TIA Craft and all these people, they tell you, make plans for retirement. That's not depressing you. That's just good sense. That's common sense.
But probably that is much easier.
Huh?
But this is realistic.
Yes, it's difficult. It's difficult. It's not easy, right? That's why we have a lifetime to practice, right? Yeah. Gradually, slowly, we can work our way.
Because what happens in life is that you are so attached to your spouse or something because you see them every day. Even if you have a dog or a cat, you're so attached to it, right? Human beings much more than that. So the point I'm trying to make is that it becomes very difficult to attach to somebody whom you have never seen in life.
Yes.
You know, like it's very difficult to get attached to Krishna because we don't see Krishna in our day to day. We hear about him, but see, for our husbands, our children, or something, we get attached because we see them. So that type of attachment, now for me at least, I don't know about others, but for me it is mechanical because I have a fear that if I don't do this, something else will happen. I will fall into this Maya and this beach again. I don't want to do that. So that love is out of fear. Or it is like my Guru Maharaj says, I have to chant, so I'm chanting, but that taste is not coming, you know? So the question is like, how do I prepare for that in my life, you know?
But your husband is really nice. Even if you're a little too attached to him, it's okay. Because he's a good devotee. And together you can be very nice devotee, right? The thing is that there's a fine balance between becoming detached and doing it prematurely. Like, you don't want to do it prematurely, otherwise it causes so much pain, it actually ends up making you more attached in the end, right? Because the pain is so great, and that develops a fear that, no, I can't become detached. This is really, really too difficult for me. And one pulls back and then doesn't want to walk the path of detachment at all, right? So it cannot be premature. But at the same time, we have to push ourselves a little bit, right? So this is why I'd say it has to be a joint endeavor. We don't have to worry about separating from each other until the age of 75, right? Up to that point, we can stay vanaprastha and be happy together. So that's most of life, right? It's almost close to death. But the point is that we have to make a plan. Okay, how can my relationship change? Detachment is not just, oh, I can't see you, I can't sit next to you. That's not detachment. Detachment means our relationship has to change. So far, the relationship has been based on how can you please my senses and I can please your senses. But now, can you cook nice food for me? Okay, I'm happy with you. You cannot, I'm not so happy today. So our happiness and distress, it becomes a product of can you please me, can you not please me? But as that relationship changes, hopefully, as it matures, then we realize that love is actually deeper when it is centered on the Lord. That we love each other because, wow, my wife really does nice service for the Lord. She's actually a very good devotee, and I've learned so much from her. And the wife thinks, actually, my husband is a really good devotee, and I've learned so many things from him, and that's a wonderful thing as well, right? So, proportionately speaking, the sense enjoyment basis has to reduce, the service basis has to increase, right? And as that increases, then we will start to see each other in a different way. And that attachment will become eternal, but it will become based on the spirit soul rather than based on the body, right? So that no doubt it will be suffering one day when we are separated from each other. It's even pure devotees feel that separation, right? Even Prabhupada, he talked about the feelings of pain that he felt when he left home. It's there in the Lilamrita, you know? But so it's not that those emotions aren't there, but you'll be able to see it in a higher light, right? You'll be able to see, oh, there is a purpose for this. And when those occasions come, before we plan, when we're torn apart in some way, emotionally with someone we love, we will be able to see it in a proper light. We'll be able to see it, say, okay, Lord Ramachandra went through this, right? I'm also going through this. There's something very important for me to learn. And yes, I prepared for this. I was never 100% prepared, but I did prepare. I was mostly there. So that's a process. It's teamwork. It's very, very important that it happens as a team together. Grihastha life, where we do our duties towards everyone, but with the exit strategy in mind.
Didn't she, the Prabhupada, say that like if both husband and wife are devotees, then there's no need even for physical separation?
Yes. So sannyas is not even necessary in Kali Yuga. Vanaprastha, Prabhupada said, is essential. Okay? And vanaprastha means what? Husband and wife stay together, but their focus becomes 100% the service of the Lord, not to enjoy each other and to get happiness from each other. That is vanaprastha. But physical separation, as in having to take sannyas from each other, is something that is not even recommended in Kali Yuga except for some very few souls, very special souls who have that ability. So, indeed. So, we have other hands up and many other questions, but we will save them for tomorrow. Tomorrow is kind of the punchline of the seminar. It's about the criticisms that are lodged against Lord Ramachandra regarding his treatment of Mother Sita and a couple of others. So we'll talk about that tomorrow and try to leave plenty of time for questions. We begin what time tomorrow?
3 o'clock.
3 o'clock in the afternoon. It goes till 5 p.m. And then after that, there's the Sunday feast program. That too will be about Lord Ramachandra. But let's end here so that we can have Gaura Aarti and worship Lord Gauranga and Sita Ramachandra. Siyavara Ramachandra ki.